When you say that the idea that men can be women is still around, I think on some level, yes, it'll always be around because there'll always be people that want to play around with those concepts, but they don't have the cultural dominance they did. Most of us who aren't completely literal-minded and black and white can play around with language all the time and know. We could just make little micro-games up between us, right, and we both know immediately what we're talking about. We could play those games for a bit, and then certain subcultures can play certain games. So all of that's going to carry on. But the problem with the trans activist stuff was that sort of what should have stayed in the realm of play got literalized, mm-hmm. got translated into pharmaceuticals and surgeries and politics and taken as if it was a sort of scientific discourse. And that's that should never have happened.
Welcome to Socrates Dialogues. I'm Mary Harrington. Today I have the immense privilege of being joined by Kathleen Stock, who is one of the original voices of clarity and reason in a very chaotic and confusing late 2010s in British politics, at a point where culture really was at a hinge moment in trying to get to grips with what is real, what is important, what is meaningful. And Kathleen was right at the forefront of all of that. In some ways which I hope we can explore today. Kathleen, welcome, and thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me, Mary. That's very kind.
So, I mean, we've known each other for a while, but you started life as a, you know, I mean, if imagine the movie trope, you know, with the record scratch moment. One, you know, there you are minding your own business as a mild-mannered, unassuming University of Sussex professor of philosophy. It was aesthetics.
It was philosophy of fiction and imagination, which got badged as aesthetics, but it wasn't really about art. It was about the mind.
That's right. Actually. So the philosophy of fiction and what it means to write or create or engage with fiction.
Yeah. What is fiction? What is belief? And relationship to imagination as well. Yeah.
And then there was a record scratch moment.
Going along with the mild mannered metaphor, surely it's like going to a phone box and I come out a culture warrior. But yeah, I absolutely had no activist side to me, no public facing side to me at all. But I did write a blog post that I self-published on Medium about the Gender Recognition Act. And that's my record scratch moment, I guess.
And then what happened when you published that? What did it say? Because I mean, it feels like a lot has happened since then, hasn't it?
It was so unbelievably anodyne. It was like, we should be able to ask questions. I didn't even answer the questions about whether... So this was in response to the Gender Recognition Act, which was coming down the... changes to the Gender Recognition Act that were coming down the pipes. It looked like everyone, all political parties, as you know, were for it. Sorry. And I just said... we need to raise questions about whether making self-ID in gender identity relevant to women's spaces and resources was a good idea. And we need to, in order to do that, we needed to be able to question whether trans women were in fact women. But I didn't pronounce, and I was very, very careful to articulate it in a way that, I mean, I think I developed all these weird concatenations like... women who are not trans women hyphenated and stuff like that, just to try and make it a little
if
bit
only
more
there was a
soft-edged.
Word.
Yeah, I know. Soon enough, I realised that's not going to work. These people didn't want to listen to me anyway. So yeah, all I did was publish that, and then there was a sort of local big fuss in philosophy that then kind of... Then I wrote another one, then people started attacking me. So from then on, it was a kind of... A certain group would attack me that was quite small. I would write a response. A bigger group would attack me. I would write a response. And the group attacking me just got bigger and bigger. And my sort of notoriety went from philosophy to academia to the public, you know, that sort of thing, before you knew it.
When was this?
It was 2018.
2018, yeah. That feels about right. Mm. I mean, I came to the great question of whether or not men can be women via Mumsnet. I think. And there was a point, actually, early on in that whole argument, I remember arguing vociferously for the other side in about, for sure, right. I was a fully paid up butlerite.
Well, I know your past, your checkered past, I think, a little bit.
That's right. I have a checkered history with many tours and detours. And in the late aughts, I was still a fully paid up butlerite. and was arguing passionately for...
Right.
But really, because I never really thought about the question as it applied to men. I'd only ever the only trans people I'd ever encountered had been women, and the safeguarding, bluntly, the safeguarding issues had simply never occurred to me.
Yeah.
And from the perspective of trans-identified lesbians, as they generally are, it seemed to me there just wasn't really an issue, and you know, we could all make believe and be nice about it, and it wasn't, you know, and I remember arguing that passionately on Mumsnet in sort of late aughts or 2010 or thereabouts, and being yelled at by the radical feminists who were already very well organized and mobilized and articulated in their views, and a boil under the surface on Mumsnet. And by degrees over the course of the tens, I sort of came to think that no, actually there was a bit more to the question than that, and I suppose we sort of converged on it from opposite directions. What do you think it was about the 2010s that made this suddenly such a burning issue?
I think popular feminism, by which I mean sort of the approved version amongst young women, had got a lot of energy. Mm. There seemed to be a succession of big moments. In the UK, these included the Everyday Sexism website with Laura Bates.
I remember that, yeah.
Caroline Criado Perez getting... a woman on a banknote, I've forgotten, Marie Curie or someone like that. They're just these sort of big, and then there was the Me Too stuff and the Pussy Hat thing and the Women's March and all of that just kind of...
Intersectionals happened.
Well, intersectional was, I mean, all of the theory had been, insofar as you can call it theory, had been laid down for decades. Mm. I mean, academics had been plugging away at that, setting up a structure, but nobody took it particularly seriously, I think, apart from gender studies departments. And I suppose it was avant-garde as well in academia. So when women's studies departments were becoming gender studies departments under the influence of Butler, which was sort of spreading out across like ripples across a pond. But why, you know, why that hooked up with this energy around the internet.
Tumblr seems to have... I mean, Mumsnet radicalized one corner of the population. Tumblr certainly, Tumblr did something in, it seems to have been a vector for the greater woke.
So there's lots of different vectors. One of them is the kind of, this kind of activist energy looking for a new cause. And also, I mean, I suppose it had so much success, that feminist inverted commas background of empowerment and so on for women, that there probably had to be a kind of, because it's always the same in women's movements, a sort of correction towards guilt and self-abasement immediately afterwards. And, you know, it was very effectively turned immediately into, oh my God, we are overprivileged. We need to abase ourselves before this new set of ideas. But at the same time, Tumblr had been going for a while with kids, trying out new identities on the internet, obviously completely unrestrained by reality or having to get jobs or anything, and driven by all the social dynamics that tend to energize teenagers. And so Tumblr, as Angela Nagel points out very well, Tumblr was the kind of other side of 4chan. Mm-hmm. And that's where all the girls were getting kind of into hyper female behaviors, sort of a distorted, amplified by not having connection to reality and all going on virtually. So all of these things then sort of mashed up. But, you know, I'm sure there's other things too. To be honest, I don't think about this that much anymore. I used to have lots of theories, and now I can't even remember my own theories.
Yeah. it weirdly feels like a long time ago, doesn't it? I mean, I suppose you know, 2018 was. I mean, it's not quite a decade.
It's a long time ago.
It feels like the culture's changed so much since then.
I think it has. Well, certainly... For me, I mean, this is just biographical, but I just was in that space for so long, thinking about all that stuff for so long, I just completely ran out of energy. And also took a lot, as we all know, or some people know, took a lot of flack for it. And it just became...
It was very particularly costly for you, I think.
Yeah, I mean, costly, there were benefits too, but it definitely was grueling. Mm. And I didn't want the rest of my life to be defined by my thinking about those things when they're so boring. I mean, it's it's kind of boring to be pointing out reality that most people still really on some level understand perfectly well, but they've just all been pretending they didn't for a while. You're not really explaining anything they didn't know, but you're trying to find a sort of academically respectable way for them to come back.
But there is something really crazy-making, isn't there, about feeling like feeling obliged, sort of socially pressured to make the academic case for something which is just obviously true.
Yeah. Oh.
There's something completely insane.
Very crazy-making, and of course it puts you in this terrible position where For most people who are still sane, not much on the internet and don't really know what's going on, like, why are you bothering with this stuff? Why?
Right.
This is so intellectually impoverished. You're wasting your life explaining there's two sexes. And that has social consequences. And of course, this is never going to come to anything. And of course, they, in a way, they were sort of right. But it, you know,
well, you say that
they had a jolly good go.
There are plenty of places in the world where still, you know, that is now, that's now the law.
Yeah, but I just, in some part of me thinks, I suppose I go back and forth on this. Some part of me thinks it was always going to burn itself out, but then I think, well, if people like us hadn't stood up and said anything, it wouldn't have done. So I don't know, but it's just so stupid and so counter to the way reality is. And it's so bad for people who get caught up in it, so manifestly bad to their flourishing, not in difficult to detect ways, but in absolutely obvious ways that manifest themselves in their physical well-being and their mental health. You know, how could that carry on for decades? It just couldn't, it seems to me.
Yeah.
But then again, if we hadn't fought it, who knows where we'd be? I just don't know about that.
Yeah. So gender, but I mean, it was a very serious and very meaningful and, as you say, completely cross-party push in the 2018s, which feels a million miles away now. Like, maybe we did win this one, but I don't, you know, I mean, you know, they only have to win once, it feels like sometimes. We didn't lose that time. You know, gender self-identification didn't become law, at least not in the United Kingdom.
No, it didn't.
In England.
And I think that's because if you can bear to keep pointing out the obvious downsides over and over and over and over again to people and explaining it, get past all the baffling language and the claims of victimhood and all the rest of it and just keep explaining it, no one sensible could possibly disagree with you.
It felt significant to me that it was predominantly mothers and lesbians who led the charge, and then eventually everybody else accepted it. But I think those are two groups of women for whom it is particularly salient as an issue. Your sex is, it's more obvious to you for different reasons that sex actually really does matter.
I think, yes, that's true. I also think that at that point in the 2010s, any man who might have had an opinion about it was absolutely cowed into silence.
Yes.
By
the feminist
stuff I was just talking
about.
The pussy
hats and the Me Too.
Sit down,
stay
in your lane. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, we're doing this on our own. And also, the other thing is, it was, despite the popular idea that this was spearheaded by men, it was, I mean, there were some influential men in trans activism. There still are. And I mean men, men in dresses, but they're still men.
Right.
But it's the most people sort of operationalizing all the ideas were women, and most people doing all the counseling were women.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of women against women kind of thing going on. And it's difficult for men at the best of times to get involved in that.
I imagine most would want to run in the direction of away.
Yeah.
But what I found consistently interesting and actually still find interesting, these are all battles which, you know, God willing, are now under the bridge, and, you know, we're not going to have let's hope we don't have to keep relitigating those. But the underlying argument, it seems to me, has not gone away. That there were two competing accounts of reality in the question, you know, can men be women? And somehow, you know, the issue was fought tactically on the question of gender identity, but in a sense, I don't know if it's been won substantively, in the sense that those two competing accounts of reality are still there and they're still duking it out. And I suppose I would I don't want to make it as reductive as, you know, nominalism versus something more scholastic. But, you know, there's a constructivist view of reality that says, you know, our ideas are part of what makes a thing a thing. And then there's another view which says, no, actually, things have a reality in their own right.
I mean, there's
and
a
you're,
sort of...
you're the philosopher, so perhaps you can perhaps you can provide the technical terms.
Well, I mean, there's a different position from either of those, or I think it is, which says, look, reality is reality. The words don't change the things, at least not in every realm. There are some realms like finance and things like where over time, so there's a clear social construction. But it's we've got lots of different words to describe the same set of facts. And some of them are more sort of playful. Some of them involve pretense. Some of them involve fictions, useful fictions. And we do it all the time. And we cycle between different vocabularies and discourses mm-hmm. all the time. Like we can... So there's one way, a very sort of rigid way, to say those two discourses you just mentioned, they're completely at odds with each other mm-hmm. and you have to pick a team. But no, you like mm-hmm. Well, most of us who aren't completely literal-minded and black and white can play around with language all the time and know. We could just make little micro games up between us right. and right, we both right. know immediately what we're talking about. We could play those games for a bit. And then certain subcultures can play certain games. So all of that's going to carry on. But the problem with the trans activist stuff was that sort of what should have stayed in the realm of play and a subculture of... I mean, it was never very useful. Got literalized, mm-hmm. got translated into pharmaceuticals and mm. surgeries and politics, mm. and taken as if it was a sort of scientific discourse, and mm. that's that should never have happened. But so when you say that the idea that men can be women is still around, I think on some level, yes. It'll always be around because there'll always be people that want to play around with those concepts, but they don't have the cultural dominance they did. I can't see, of course, anything can happen, but there's not the energy behind that stuff anymore. Energy's going in different directions now, and they're not that interested in that one, I don't think.
I hosted on my Substack a fun piece from a young guy who's not as gender critical as perhaps you or I, but mm. he's sort of one of these Americans who's ethnically ambiguous. He has his ancestry is from all over the place, and he gets mistaken for various different ethnicities. And he wrote an actually very playful article saying, "Well, why can't we play with race?" which, I mean, is a fairly provocative thing to say in the context of American race politics. But he extended that to gender as well to say, you know, why can't we play in the space of, you know, the androgyne and all these different ways you can sort of push the envelope of normative genders without having to reify it?
You can play as long as you know it's play, I think. I mean, I'm not one of those people that's always, you know, correcting... Mm. Misgendering wherever I find it. I mean, misgendering in the...
correctly.
In the correct... Sorry, yes. I don't know. Misgendering as in what the trans activists would call... No, I can't even work out my own...
Which one is the misgendering? No, which one is...
I'm not going around going, it's a man all the time when it is, even though I know it's a man. But I think it just... We can play, it's fine, but like there is something decadent about play when it becomes the central concern of the establishment. And for a while that seemed to be there's something deeply frivolous about spending a lot of time, political energy on gender.
Why do you think that happened? You know, because I think you're right. You know, if we sort of zoom out from either the metaphysics of cross-dressing or, you know, the philosophy of play.
The metaphysics of cross-dressing.
To coin a phrase. I mean, it does have a metaphysics, but let's just swerve that.
Everything's got a metaphysics.
I know. Thankfully, my job is also my hobby.
Yeah.
it's not cross-dressing, my hobby, just to be clear. But, you know, zooming out, you know, I think you're right that it's as though it was a displacement activity.
It was a total displacement. It was a, so, it I was mean, a would self-regarding, you... virtue signaling is the right term. It was a luxury belief, status accruing exercise by people.
You know, at the risk of being crypto-Marxist, do you think it makes more sense in the context of the crash and everything which has come since the crash?
Why?
I mean, in the sense, you know, if you want to talk, you know, thinking about, you know, the crash kind of broke everything. And in ways which I think are still broken. I mean, certainly everything has been broken in Britain pretty much since 2008 at a very deep level that I think is still working itself out. The economy came unmoored from reality in a very fundamental way with the bank bailout. And quantitative easing hasn't really stopped since then. And there's a sort of coming away from reality of the entire money system. And, you know, could you make the case that that gender became such a sort of fixation because there's a kind of Weimar situation brewing?
You could. I wouldn't. But that's because I just don't think like that. But what I would say... sorry. just don't. But one thing I would say is, for me, it's... And you can connect... You can explain the economic substructure, but... I think it's of a piece with the general turn to nostalgia that seems to be around, that like...
Interesting.
Basically, what the straight white university educated person is grew up in a time where there was a lot of status attached to LGB activism, and somehow through the 90s that narrative got absolutely embedded that, you know, there'd been AIDS, there'd been Section 28. There had been a noble correction of homophobia in the law and things like that. So, and that people just want to get back to that. You know, I think that's what they, you know, the way they go on about this is just like Stonewall. Mm-hmm. It's actually a nostalgia for something they don't even have, because they usually... By Stonewall, they mean what happened in New York, mm-hmm. not what happened in London. But I think it's just playing the hits of the 90s in a different key. That's what I think it is.
And I know people have made the case that Stonewall, the organisation, I mean, the British ACT Gay, Gay and LGB, now also QWERTY++ organisation, sort of ran out of things to do after gay marriage.
Yes,
And so did the sums and think, okay, we need a new source of, we need something new to fundraise on.
Yeah, because they had access to every politician in Britain. They had loads and loads of money. They had all these staff networks about every blue chip and public sector organisation. They weren't going to just roll that all back. They needed a new project. They also were run by idiots, to be honest. I mean, a lot of this is, you can't underestimate how stupid the people that sort of put this in. They had absolutely no idea what they were doing. I've heard people report secondhand conversations with Ruth Hunt, who was in charge of Stonewall when they added the T to their ambitions and decided to go for self-ID and everything else that followed. And she would say things like, you know, we should be giving puberty blockers to children because, like, imagine if one of those children who didn't get it grew up to be in the wrong body. You know, how awful would that be? And that's supposed to be the sort of intuition pump that moves us to give puberty blockers just
to all of them.
Huge numbers of children, just in case one of those children who hadn't got them would have ended up, right, you know, in a great big post-pubescent body they didn't want. And then it just doesn't seem to occur to her, by the sound of it, what happens to all the false positives on your story. You know, they were so mired in, like I say, completely daft, believing several impossible things before breakfast just to keep the money going, basically.
I remember being very struck over the course of all the interminable internet battles and all the ramifying discourse about this stuff. You know, some of what emerged about how Stonewall operates, or how the Stonewall certification scheme operates, or I don't know if it still does. The Stonewall Diversity Champions, I think it's called.
It was that, and then there's a workplace scheme as well.
That's right. Which are these certification schemes for anyone who's not familiar with this. Whereby you sign up to the scheme, you give Stonewall fids of money, obviously that's, and then they come in and do training courses for you, and you basically agree to entrench their to Kathleen and me completely bonkers prescriptions, like, you know, you must erase every mention of sex. Any sex-specific reference to anything, including in your HR policies on pregnancy, for example.
Yeah. menopause.
And you're not allowed single sex, but yeah, anything. All of these things are forbidden. You must basically gender neutralize everything. And the more extreme you are about this, and the more you escalate every year, the more you can compete in their league table for the most unhingedly rainbow coded organization. Companies were very into this for a long time. It seems to have sort of gone out of fashion, mercifully, slightly.
Well, totally. I mean, Stonewall's just a shell of itself now. But at the time, yes. I mean, in my former institution, like as in many universities, the management would say when they came like 105th on the workplace rankings, they'd be like, we will learn from this. It is our aim. As part of our 5-year plan, they built it in. We will be in the top 25. And wow. Then it was explicitly mentioned as a goal that they were going to get. And of course, this meant that Stonewall would mark their homework on everything from sports policies, changing room policies, privacy policies, and also then all a bunch of secondary policies about hate crimes, transphobia, and curriculum stuff as well. So, yeah. It was such a big work project. You can see, like, they didn't have much else to do, and now they had to erase mention of the female sex across every institution in Britain. That's like a massive job. So, but it's also very simple. It's like, it's not. You don't need to be a genius to work out. You can be like, oh yeah, there's sex in this domain, and there's sex in this domain, and there's this sex in this domain. Right? Okay, we're going to get rid of all that. Quite simple.
And when you step back and you think about what's going on there, that people are sort of outsourcing the entire moral and, you know, large chunks of the disciplinary framework of their organization, and, you know, sometimes completely reorienting their corporate or institutional raison d'etre around what is fundamentally, you know, a company which is subsisting. You know, I mean, it's not officially a commercial enterprise, but people are earning money. You know, people are taking respectable salaries. They've got these enormous, enormous coffers of money which come in. You're paying essentially to be given. I mean, it's people have made the parallel with the sale of indulgences at the end of the Middle Ages, and I think it feels apt, actually.
Yes, but you've got to remember the university sector was doing it because they thought the students wanted it, and they were desperate for the student fees, and that's an important part of every discussion about whatever universities do. It's in a sense, it's not stupid to go along with this massive social trend. Or at least certainly not stand against it when all your competitors are doing it. And this would be a way of branding yourself in a way that attracted students, or you hope it would. Certainly, and it got to a point where so many universities were already signed up that anyone who wasn't would just look like a completely out of touch antediluvian, possibly transphobic organization. So, you know, it got a life of its own, which, as to repeat, I don't think is there anymore. I think there'll be little pockets of resistance. There'll be really annoying activists in each university, but everyone will be now thoroughly sick of the whole thing and just wish it would go away, I think.
Well, let's hope so. So do you think that's really just a matter of fashion? It's a function.
I mean, in that case,
did we win? Did the TERFs win?
I think we did. I'm not saying, like, obviously battles are, this battle may never be over, or at least who knows if we're in a war, and this is just one battle, and there'll be another one, like the Hundred Years' War. There'll be another one in 25 years or something.
I mean, for example, when I was preparing for this conversation and thinking about what I wanted to talk about with you, I looked you up on Wikipedia just to see what the Wikipedia.
I never do that.
No. I don't look myself up either on principle. Yeah, it's a very unwise thing to do. Yeah. But I noticed just how larded the whole article is with references to cis women. And you know, and at one point it's a, you know, one of Dr. Stock's beliefs is that sex is binary, a viewpoint which is disputed by some scientific theories. You know, footnote. And I'm thinking, you know, this is, you know, it hasn't gone away, or at least amongst the subset of people who are obsessively
editing
Wikipedia.
Boring people that upset. Sorry, no offense to any listeners, but you know, the people that update Wikipedia. That's quite a niche subculture. I think just to say that whole Wikipedia page was set up originally by a hostile people who originally put my age in as like 69, and quite a lot of people thought I was very old, and they thought I looked quite good for my age for quite a long time.
I mean,
time.
If that's true, I want to know what moisturiser you use.
Yeah, well, no, I'm not. But I think that, yes, it's not coming at us like it was in this massive wave with all parties signed up to it. The BBC signed up to it. The Guardian signed up to it. Basically, there are pockets where establishment organisations are trying to find a way out from the mess they've got themselves into, but they recognise it's a mess where they didn't even see it before, they were completely blind. One obvious place where there's still huge problems is the puberty blocker trial, which is still going ahead, run by King's College. That shouldn't be happening. I mean, there's just no rationale for it. And there is, so there's obvious activists, powerful in the NHS.
And in the Labour Party.
And in the Labour Party and in the Guardian and at the BBC. But there are other people who are prepared to come up against them. And that was just not the case then. And I think that, and also the law is now on our side. It won't affect the puberty blocker trial, but the law in terms of women's spaces and resources is now on our side, thanks to the Supreme Court decision in our favour. So I just can't see a world in which it's going to get worse. I can see where there'll be stasis for a while in certain areas and gradually over time. Yes, and as you say, the fashion is changing. The Gen Z are not really into it in the same way. So when it'll change, I think. I think we had to push back really, really, really hard. And there's still great organisations in the UK like Sex Matters who are just plugging away at like every single manifestation of trans activism that's still out there. Mm. They are, it's like whack-a-mole, but they're not popping up as often.
And the University of Sussex was fined £585,000?
I don't remember.
It was a lot.
It was, but
they deserved it.
Yeah, but then they appealed and now they're not fined that anymore. So,
but that was brutalizing. I mean, I was nowhere near what happened to you, but it was clear even as an outsider that, that must have been a horrendous atmosphere to have been in.
It was a horrendous.
I don't want to re-traumatize. Yeah, the most prominent. So if you don't want to go there, then
the most prominent sort of part of it was right at the end, when I just decided I've had enough, when there was like protesters coming to campus and stuff like that. But over several years, I had been basically very isolated psychologically and in every other way, and treated pretty much like a sort of embarrassment that we have to put up with through gritted teeth. But it was obvious, the vibes from people that, you know, I otherwise liked and respected, that they just wish that I would just stop writing about this. Yeah. And so there was when anything happened to me, and lots of things happened to me, there was never a sense of like outrage on my behalf. Mm. It was more like, well, she did ask for it. Nobody said that, but there was just a lot of.
Everyone just assumed you were asking for it.
I think they. Yes, I think there is that. You know, why did she keep going? If she didn't like it so much, why did she keep going? She's still talking, isn't she? You know, all that stuff that people say defensively.
And there's a sense in which that's still alive and well. I seem to remember there was a young woman recently at Cambridge who's now become the next victim, you know, in the great circle of cancellation. Possession of your book, in fact, was the proximate cause of her being cancelled.
Yes. I mean,
somebody spotted it. It was under her bed, I think. It really wasn't. It wasn't like she glued it to her door or something like that.
Even worse, she's got something to hide. She knows that's bad.
It was some. Yeah, she just like been kicked under the bed. Yeah,
I just so much of this seems to me like what horrible mean girls do to, you know, to bully other girls, and I think that was going on for me too. You know, that's a dynamic that's ancient, and this was just a way in which you can in a Cambridge college for a first year to basically be completely ostracized by all the women in her college, and most of them will be just going along with it because they don't want to be bullied as well, but you know, we know what that is. That's not new.
No, but it sort of raises the question, you know, what if anything could or should be done about it? You know, is it the place of a university to intervene when something like that happens?
Intervene depends what you mean. I don't know too much about that case. But no, but generally speaking, if it was the case for me, and it would be the case for her, that if the powers that be, the dons, the lecturers, from the top down, came out and said to all students in all possible circumstances, we don't do that here. We don't you know, ostracize people for philosophical beliefs that they hold. And actually, not just that, but the gender critical ones amongst them should say so, because mm-hmm. that's the thing. Quite a lot of people do agree with us, but don't say so.
That's right.
And nobody, if they all did say so,
nobody
be a
wants
very
to
different...
be the Girardian scapegoat.
Exactly. But if they all did it at the same time, like I had a friend, a philosopher friend, years ago, who said, why don't we just all get badges and say, I believe in two sexes or whatever it was, and then we'll all put them on at the same time. Okay, good typical philosopher's idea. This is never going to work.
I mean, on the young woman in question seems to have been made of fairly stern stuff. You know, she's doubled and tripled down and started the Cambridge Society for Women.
Yes, and I'm sure that she's probably ultimately glad this happened to her, because it does teach you lots and lots of things, and it, you know, your character is forged in fire.
I mean, a character-forming experience.
It is. It really is.
It
totally is.
I mean, do you think what happened to you was character-forming?
Yes, definitely. Oh, yes. I mean, I'm not scarred. Well, if I am scarred, fine. They've healed, you know. Oh. I mean, I've learned a lot. I've confirmed a lot of thoughts I had about people, in a good way and a bad way. And I wasn't completely alone. You know, some people came to help, and they were great, you know.
Mm. So what do you think the prognosis is for academia in general? Because, I mean, it seems to me that there's you've spoken about the commercial incentives for universities towards coddling and towards adopting, you know, moral fashions and, you know, the sense in which they're providing a consumer service, which seems inimical to the academic project, at least conceived of in a more classical sense. You know, is there anywhere in the academy for disagreeable nerds anymore? I don't mean disagreeable as in unpleasant. I mean disagreeable as in not inclined to go along with consensus just because.
Yes, I think so. I think we should never. I've been a strong critic of many universities, including my former institution, but most students are still like they always were. Mm-hmm. And they were right up until the moment I left, and I'm pretty sure that's still true. There are people having robust disagreements in philosophy classes at the moment, although possibly not about gender, because I do think that's become so difficult, and maybe not about race, stuff like that. But if it's abstract enough and doesn't have many real-world consequences, or even something like abortion, I think there's probably still some room for people to disagree in universities. The coddling thing, I mean, it's, again, take it back to fees. Universities don't know what they're supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. Are they in loco parentis? Because a lot of parents seem to think they are. Parents come to the open days with their prospective students now, which never happened for me. Whenever there's a terrible student suicide, the coroner will always criticise the university for not doing enough to look after or quite often anyway, and then the universities absolutely panic and try and chuck loads of mental health stuff in.
Weirdly at odds with the idea of votes at 16, don't you think?
Yes, it was absolutely doesn't fit with, you know, nothing fits together in this world. But it is, but the money imperative to get the students in and therefore persuade the parents that this is a safe place, especially in smaller universities, which will make a lot of their sort of community feeling, and anywhere where there's an emphasis on social cohesion, it's, there'll be ostracism of people who don't go along, particularly amongst young people. The Equality Act, I mean, I'm not getting into a sort of large-scale discussion about that, but the reasonable adjustment thing as it manifests itself in universities means that hardly anyone ever does an exam.
You
know, it's all like open book, or else it's online, or else it's dissertation work. They get extra, you know, I've said this a million times, but there's not enough rooms to give for exams anymore, because so many people need their own room and their own scribe and their own support network and all the rest of it. And that's because universities understand reasonable adjustments very liberally.
Wow. When I were a lass, it was just a big room with somebody sat at the back, and
I mean,
you had 3 hours.
It happens in engineering
there,
and things like that. But in the humanities, it's just also, I mean, it's a perfect storm, because obviously AI means that a lot of them are cheating, and now we can't tell because we can't get them back in the room to give them exams, because they've all got reasonable adjustments. For 40% of students or something like that, ridiculous, in some universities have a disability, which is either autism, depression, anxiety, or something like that. So they're in a terrible mess. They can't get out of it. They think, you know, they're legally obliged to do these things. Some of them, they think they are. And they're very, very bad for the students.
What do you think AI is going to... How do you see that playing out? This is something...
Well, they can't eradicate cheating now. They just can't do it.
So, I mean, presumably the end point of that is either that the degree stops meaning anything as a certificate, or the meaning of that certificate changes, or they go back to Viva defences.
Well, it won't mean anything useful to employers very soon if it does already.
I mean, if that hasn't already happened.
Yeah, it's probably already happened. So, how I think it will play out, if I know universities, is that they will be totally stuck and unable to meet the challenge because of trying to be all these different things at once: pastorally, caring, continuing to bring students in, responsive to activist concerns, all of this.
And also insanely in debt.
Yeah, very in debt, and competing with other universities, so trying to do whatever they're doing. I mean, there might be room for the occasional university to sort of say, right, we're going to do it completely differently. We want all the psychologically well-balanced students who can handle a two-hour exam. We'll take them, and then the degree that comes out at the end will mean something. But it's just awful, because those kids who are not cheating, they're now at a positive disadvantage to those that are.
I asked, I have a second cousin, I think a second cousin. Anyway, she's university age and doing a degree at the moment in Australia. Good university, smart kid. I asked her, what percentage of your peers do the work? Mm. And what percentage just use AI? She said roughly 10% do the work.
Yeah,
which actually tallies.
That
I remember
seems very high, but yeah. I mean low.
Right. I mean, I walked down a plane flying between the west and east coast of America and counted who was reading long form and who was just scrolling. Again, it was roughly 10%. Mm. So to me, that feels about right. And that's isn't that? And if I remember rightly, that's roughly the proportion of the population that
used to go to university.
So, you know, maybe there's a signal there. I don't know.
We need to get those people. Yeah. new set of institutions.
If only there was some institution where we could just
set aside. Why don't we call the new ones technical colleges?
I don't know. You know, maybe there's something there that we could work with. Yeah. I don't know. But so you've moved on from the gender wars. I mean, God help, you know, God willing, we're all going to be able to move on from the gender wars. And your new book out this year is Do Not Go Gentle. Mm. You know, the title taken from Dylan Thomas's very moving poem to his dying father. Mm-hmm. And it's about assisted death, or medically enabled suicide, or whatever you want to call it. What prompted you to engage with that?
Kind of similar in emotionally, in the sense that the bill arrived in the UK. There was an attempt a couple of years ago. Suddenly a private member's bill arrived that was going to put assisted death on the books in the context of the NHS. And it passed its second reading. It passed its third reading. And I was like, what? You know, we haven't discussed this. We haven't thought about it. And I'd been keeping an eye on what was happening in other countries. But I didn't think it could. I just thought I had all these horror stories had no relevance to us.
Right.
And then suddenly I don't know why I thought that, but obviously I was naive just like before. Suddenly it was there. And then I just had this huge personal feeling that I had to lay out a case philosophically against it, because I didn't think people were paying attention to things I could see as really salient. I thought they were. So, yeah, I mean, in between those books, I've been pissing around with ideas, but nothing got the energy behind it that this did. Mm-hmm. And you know, so I raced to write it. It came out just before the bill ran out of time in the Lords. Mm-hmm. And now the identical bill is back. Mm-hmm. So
what's, I mean, what do you see as the central issue? What's the argument?
The issue isn't about assisted death as it happens in the individual level, interpersonally between this person and this person. The issue is about the systematization of killing people or helping them commit suicide in the context of medicine, calling it a form of healthcare. Mm. And I mean, there's so many different issues there, but it basically corrupts the concept of medicine and healthcare. Mm. It erodes trust in doctors. It leads to sorts of unjust or just gut-wrenching, terrible outcomes. And it also becomes a kind of economically attractive way of dealing with suffering, mm-hmm. old age and illness over time. It starts off circumscribed, but it's a very seductive way of thinking that,
that
you know,
slope is very slippery.
Well, once you've already conceded that, like, helping people die is actually a kindness and a really good thing for suffering, and also what they really want. So you're kind of just all these things wrapped up in a lovely bow. Why would you fund palliative care, which is much more expensive? Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't you start putting on pressure, subtle pressure, on people to take this route? Because it's really nice and it's really effective. It's a really effective way of ending suffering. So,
isn't it 10% of deaths in Canada now?
Not that high, I don't think. I think last time I looked, it was like 5.7%, I think, something like that. But yeah, it'll get there. I don't see why it won't get there.
But there are, I mean, a real horror story crosses my radar occasionally. This isn't something I track in any detail, but you see cases of people where pressure has clearly been exerted, or people have opted in Canada for what they now call quote unquote Canadian healthcare, which is to say a doctor will come and bump you off, or even just a provider of bumping off services will come and bump you off because they're too disabled to live, to be able to live they have a disability and they can't access the resources they need to live comfortably.
I mean, it's not a systematic decision. I mean, I'm not conspiratorial about it. I don't think that that's the idea, but I think that these cases inevitably come up.
But the incentives push in that direction.
Yeah, exactly. The incentives push, and then you get these medics who only ever think about what's happening here, and they think, well, we've got two options here, so I'm going to present them both. Yeah. And actually, your social care package is going to take 10 months, and we haven't really got enough pain controlling meds to sort that out, but we've got this third thing that government has ratified, that, you know, there's loads of posters up and educational resources about, and, you know, have you thought about this? And I think that's dystopian.
And there's a conscience question as well, isn't there? Because I mean, my sense is that a lot of people who work in hospice care, for example, you know, are drawn to do that, you know, as an expression of faith, for example, and for whom being obliged to include medically assisted suicide in their palliative care options would simply not be possible.
Yes, and some systems do have opt out, like the America. It's coming to New York, I think, soon, and I looked at their law that's coming in recently, and there was an opt out for faith-based institutions. But
although the slope can be didn't Barack Obama take the Little Sisters of the Poor to court for refusing to provide abortion services?
Possibly.
Which is one of those cartoonish hands are we the bad guys scenario.
Kit Malthouse in the UK during the committee stage said that basically hospices implied that it might be an idea to defund hospices who weren't on board. I mean, that's the thing. Once you present it as a matter of justice, as choice, care, kindness, mercy, all these good things, how can they not give it? You know, are they monsters?
That's right. What kind of a monster are you for refusing to kill Granny?
Yeah, exactly.
It's especially potty when, you know, we shut down the entire world years ago because, you know, if you didn't do that, then you were about to kill Granny. But you know, this is
can psychoanalyze that swing. It's a bit like from Me Too to, you know, women sit down and know your place. Granny was everything. Now kill Granny. I mean. Yeah, in a
that's
way.
Really
I don't
dark,
know what's going but on, but
maybe there's
backlash.
Something to that. That's kind of dark. It also seems to me that there's a thematic link between your engagement with the gender question and your engagement with the medical, and not just because they're both corruptions. Well, really fundamentally, they are both corruptions of healthcare, in a sense.
Yeah, they both are, absolutely, and they both have. The same kind of very impoverished moral vocabulary behind them, in the sense that if you could sort of boil down, you can certainly boil down the defences of assisted dying to either freedom, autonomy. I should do what I want with my body, even though you're asking somebody else to do it for you. So it's not really autonomy at all.
Yeah,
or
I mean, if you were a real
mercy.
Radical autonomist, couldn't you? Obviously, though, you know, this is not something anybody should ever talk about.
No, I mean, I've got a whole
theory.
Section of my book about how there is no right to non-interference in your own suicide. You know, I don't actually think suicide prevention is a good thing. Right. I think there should be suicide watches. I think that we should interfere when people are trying to end their
lives.
However, when people go bang on about autonomy, I'm just pointing out that there is an autonomous route available to most people, even in terminal
what
illness.
What they want is the government.
But they don't
stamp.
Want that.
No, they want the
what they
stamp.
Want is assistance.
Yeah.
What they want is actually not doing something for yourself, which is precisely the opposite of autonomy. So all I'm doing is pointing out the incoherency in the argument. I'm not.
And again, there's a parallel there with the gender thing, isn't it? Because I mean, in theory, you could, you know, this is J.K. Rowling's point: wear what you like.
Yeah, but you can't really cut off your own breasts and stuff like that.
I suppose. I mean, once you get into the biomedical interventions, yes. But there's a sense in which the real ask is about institutional protection in both cases.
It's presented in the same way. In the same incoherent way. I should have the right to do what I want with my body. It's my body. It's my choice. Now, please, doctor, would you please do this thing and make it free?
Yes.
But at the same time, for the very same set of people, sometimes, actually, these people are very vulnerable. You need to protect them. You need compassion. They need this thing. Nothing to do with autonomy, to do with, helping them survive. I mean, it's not, in the case of assisted death, it's not helping them survive, but it's more like putting an end to this absolutely awful suffering. So that's the compassion motive, and then there's the freedom motive. But in both cases, they work against each other.
There's a very sort of odd reading of dignity as well, isn't there?
Oh, yeah, in assisted dying, absolutely. I mean, dignity just reduces to like being dignified or something like that. So basically, severely ill people are not dignified.
It seems to me that that has some dystopian sort
wrong.
Of follow throughs. The moment you propose that, you know, somebody is sufficiently disabled, they lose dignity.
Yeah.
You're opening the door to all kinds of things which, you know, we said never again about in 1945.
Disabled activists make this point very profoundly and clearly, that there's a big crossover between terminally ill people and disabled people in terms of the things that people find undignified, like loss of bodily functions, inability to move around. The defender of assisted death will often say, oh yes, but it's only undignified if I think it's undignified for me. I can only make that choice for me, and I've judged that this is, you know, I don't want to have my bodily needs, my bodily fluids mopped up by somebody else. You know, I just want to die. But if that was just your decision and it wasn't like a policy across a state,
it's a complete
you could
denial
say that.
There's...
But once you've brought the policy in and you've said this condition is basically, if you think it's undignified, it's undignified. It's not the subjectivity that does that. It's an agreement that there is something a bit.
There's this determined blindness as well, isn't there, to the idea that your choices have social consequences. You know, there's a social dimension to choices.
Yeah.
I mean, and the social dimension to the institutional and the medical technologies that we embrace.
People are not very good at noticing.
I think
the
people are very committed to not noticing.
Yeah, and actually, social construction, as I know you know, it's become a sort of bogeyman for the right and for realists, but actually lots of things are socially constructed, including feelings, in the sense that there's a real social dimension. We catch feelings from our social context all the time, and they may manifest themselves in certain kinds of psychological illness or desires or whatever. And then to just ignore all that fact, I mean, so you can see this in the puberty blocker issue, you can see this in assisted dying, to kind of just doctors, the people thinking about this just don't seem to notice how it was produced and how it might not be produced 10 years down the line.
And
yet we're doing a random controlled trial on these kids to work out what will always be the case for a child of 11 who takes puberty blockers. Of course, it will be different depending on the social context.
There's a perverse insistence on noticing social construction where something is fundamentally just real, and then insisting on not seeing it where it's actually happening.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, one example that I cite sometimes, you know, on legitimizing a particular technology and the fact that it affects everybody, including those who don't want to use it, is the contraceptive pill, which, when it was first introduced, affected even those women who didn't want to use it, because it so radically changed the entire atmosphere around how men and women behaved in relation to one another, that, you know, saying no meant something different and landed differently in a way which just hadn't been the case before. And also shotgun weddings stopped happening. Once abortion became legalised, shotgun weddings stopped. Because in theory, you could just get rid of the baby. And so those women who, for conscience reasons, didn't want to go down that route, found themselves in a situation which they hadn't been in before.
Yeah.
And you can take that framework and apply it very straightforwardly to the issues around assisted dying and the pitfalls of assisted
absolutely.
Dying.
Absolutely. I mean, even those who think especially those who think that contraception was a good thing, they should be able to notice that it had all these different effects. There shouldn't be controversy about noticing that some groups were winners and some groups were losers or thought they were losers, if you think they were really winners. But in the case of assisted death, absolutely. I mean, every single person will have this choice. As soon as they fall into the category, they tick the criteria, and the one that we're going to get in the UK, if we get it, is you just need a doctor to say that you've got 6 months to live or less. That's pretty much it. You need mental capacity and 6 months to live or less. And when you get to the end of your life as an elderly person, quite often frailty can be something that people think, well, you've got 6 months to live or less, probably. You can find doctors to say that. Now you're in the zone, and now you have to explain to yourself why you're not taking that just as much as you have to explain to yourself why you are.
That's right.
And you might have to explain it to your relatives if they
want your decision to continue existing.
And care home fees being what they are, and everybody knows how much they are, they will literally eat away the value of a house that you might have passed down to the next generation or whatever. And it's going to be really, really salient to people. Whereas now it's not salient. You could say, oh, well, you know, I don't think I'd like to do that. But it'll be a completely different order of discussion with yourself once it's there and you could take it.
I think particularly in the context of some of the intergenerational animus that you sort of ambient feeling of hostility between the the boomers took everything and they destroyed and left nothing in their way. Now we have our life is so hard. And, you know, you add assisted dying into that mix and it's like what could possibly go wrong?
I mean,
you know, I'm
sure
it's
possible that if that feeling gets sufficiently articulated so it becomes directed at your own parents, then it will have implications. But you don't really need that sort of context, that kind of bigger social context, to understand that some kids really hate their parents or really resent their parents. I mean, that's just been around for a while, and that will affect this too.
Well, let's hope this isn't Keir Starmer's final spiteful legacy.
I doubt it will be, to be honest. I think even he must have noticed by now that there are
some issues
or at least that there's not the straightforward kind of applause that he thought he might get for this.
We have to hope. So what are you working on at the moment, having published?
I'm waiting for my next wave of anger to hit. So I just write for Unheard, as you know, which keeps me busy. But I haven't got any big book project. I need to find one.
And you have a podcast?
Oh, yes. Julie Bindle and I have a podcast for this organisation we run called The Lesbian Project. It's very silly, though. I mean, I don't think there may not be much of a crossover of audiences for this and that one. We basically look at sapphic culture that week, whatever that is. It's usually absolute nonsense. And then we take the mick out of it.
So what gives you hope, other than taking the mickey out of sapphic culture for that week? What gives you hope when you think about the world as it is in all of its silliness?
I'm afraid I don't have much hope, but that's okay, because I'm sort of like
you're just not
John Gray, you know. I basically looked it in the face. I don't ever think that the stuff I write is going to really make that much difference in the end. I think these
I think it does,
hairs
actually.
Are running.
I mean, even if it just getting young women cancelled.
I thought you thought that basically the intellectuals only come in once the social movements are en route anyway. And I think that too.
I know, but that doesn't mean what you contribute is nothing.
I don't think it's nothing, but I mean, ultimately, look, the huge forces we're talking about, economic forces of decline, you know, avarice, all the rest of it, it's not going to be books that stands against that or podcasts. I don't have much hope for like the future of mankind. I certainly have no faith in progressivism of any sort, whether it's on the right or the left. AI is an absolute disaster. You know, I'm a doomer, but I'm okay with that. Like, I've sort of looked the abyss in the face and
it's staring back at us fine as well.
Basically, we just need to accept it.
And on that ambivalently cheerful bombshell, Kathleen, this has been such a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. Thank you.
You might be thinking, that's not Eric Metaxas. My name's Mary Harrington. I'm a writer and a past contributor to Socrates in the City. I'm thrilled to be joining Socrates in the City as the first inaugural Socrates contributor. Throughout 2026, I'll be hosting many fascinating conversations on life, God, and other small topics. Be sure to subscribe to get notifications whenever a new episode from Eric or myself drops. And thank you for tuning in.